Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Pim Fox, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most important, noteworthy, and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Bloomberg.com. And for details now and more details about what's going on in Iraq, we want to bring in Julian Lee, oil strategist for Bloomberg First Word. And I encourage everyone to read his latest column having to do with tensions with Kurdish separatists. And I'm just wondering, you know, Julian, great to have you with us. It's kind of difficult to even put the nomenclature of this correctly because Kurdistan has a regional government. And it just voted for full independence, and yet Iraq's government doesn't want to have anything to do with this and now has launched an assault on the city of Kirkuk. I wonder if you could explain why this is relevant and what do you believe is going on behind the scenes?
Okay, well, thank you for having me. I mean, it's great to be on the show. I think we have to sort of look at a little bit of history here. The city of Kirkuk has been disputed between the Kurdish government and the government in Baghdad really since the fall of Saddam Hussein and has been a disputed city long before that. It's not in the Kurdish region of Iraq. It's just outside it. So it wasn't under control of the Kurdish regional government. When Iraqi forces fled northern Iraq in 2014 in the face of the insurgency from the so-called Islamic State, the Kurds moved in. Kurdish forces moved in to protect Kirkuk, protect surrounding oil fields, and effectively established de facto control over the city of Kurdistan and over neighboring oil fields, a couple of which subsequently were taken over and managed by a Kurdish company. Now that Islamic State has been kicked out of northern Iraq, the federal government wants the city of Kirkuk and wants those oil fields back. The Kurdish referendum really has thrown fuel on the fire because the Baghdad government doesn't want to see Iraq split up, and indeed, nor do international governments, particularly those of Iraq's neighbors.
So how much of this, Julian, is a purely economic issue? Who gets control over these oil fields? And how important are these oil fields strategically?
I think the issue is certainly for Iraqis and for Kurds is much bigger than just control of oil. It is about national destiny and the shape of Iraq going forwards. The oil is undoubtedly important. We're not talking huge volumes in terms of the total production of Iraq itself. Most of Iraq's oil production comes from the south near the Persian Gulf. They're exporting something over 3 million barrels a day from the Persian Gulf. From northern Iraq, they're exporting about 600,000 barrels a day. So, you know, roughly a fifth of what they're exporting from the south. But the reason that it's important is that it's delivered by pipeline directly to an export terminal on Turkey's Mediterranean coast. That makes it a very close source of supply for Mediterranean refiners. And that is very attractive to them. So the loss of this oil or even a part of it would, I think, cause a dislocation for Mediterranean refiners as they look to replace this Kurdish and northern Iraqi oil with supplies from elsewhere. And that's where I think the real importance lies. Add to that the fact that we seem to be in a situation again where Middle Eastern geopolitics and the threat of conflict or indeed the actuality of conflict in oil-producing countries in the Middle East is starting to have an impact on prices.
And what about the ability of Iraqi oil producers to get the product to market?
Producers in the south of the country?
In the north?
The south is fine. Producers in the north have a big problem. The only way at the moment to get oil out of northern Iraq is through a Kurdish pipeline, which runs from the northern end of the Kirkuk field, which Kurdistan has operated for a decade and a half. And that runs up to the Turkish border and then across Turkey to a terminal on Turkey's Mediterranean coast. That is the only way of getting oil out of northern Iraq in any significant quantity, whether that's Kurdish produced and controlled oil or oil that is produced and controlled by the national government. So everybody needs the pipeline to keep running.
Julian, real quick, I'm trying to get an understanding of why we're seeing oil prices rise on this news. Is it because of the threat of a wider conflict, or is it because this could potentially take oil offline?
I think it's that it could potentially take oil offline. It could take as much as 600,000 barrels a day. There doesn't seem to be risk of the conflict spreading, although Turkey did threaten at the time of the referendum that if Kurdistan went ahead with independence, it could and would close the pipeline.
Julian Lee, thank you so much for joining us. And your story was really terrific. I recommend everyone read it. Bloomberg.com/gadfly. Julian Lee, oil strategist for Bloomberg First Word and a Gadfly columnist. President Trump last week asked the U.S. Congress to toughen the terms of a 2015 Iranian nuclear agreement, saying it doesn't do enough to contain Iranian ambitions. Here to discuss is Ariel Cohen, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, also director of the Center for Energy, Natural Resources and Geopolitics at the Institute for Analysis of Global Security. Ariel, thank you so much for joining us. Can we just go over what the main issues are that President Trump is responding to and how widely his skepticism about this deal really is shared?
First of all, thank you for having me. First of all, President Trump is consistent. He criticized the deal with Iran called JCPOA, the Obama-era deal, because it is not a good deal for the United States. The deal allows Iran to continue uranium enrichment, although this is low-enriched uranium that is used in medical research and in civilian power stations, but the capacity can be easily upgraded to create the uranium for nuclear weapons. Secondly, the deal does not stop Iranian development of ballistic missiles, including we get indications the development of ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, in the longer term. Thirdly, the deal does nothing to stop Iran from interfering throughout the Middle East. Iran is a major supporter of the brutal regime of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. It interferes in Yemen. It effectively pursues policy of surrounding our ally Saudi Arabia, both from the north. It supports Qatar. It supports Shia minority inside Saudi. It supports Shia majority in Bahrain and the Houthi rebels in Yemen. So both in terms of geopolitics, in terms of facts on the ground in the Middle East, and in terms of nuclear capability, the deal did not achieve U.S. strategic goals. And this is why Trump is not scuppering it, but it is the Trump administration is trying to push Iran to get to the negotiating table and to renegotiate the deal.
Is there any evidence, Ariel, that the strategy that the Trump administration is employing has ever worked?
The strategy has not been fully announced. I believe that decertifying Iran is a first step, but the strategy has not been articulated. And if there is one, they probably are not going to fully expose it for public consumption. In a game with the Iranians, and I cracked Iran for decades, in the game with the Iranians, you don't show your cards, you keep your cards close to your chest. Iran is a place where the chess game was invented. Granted, the Russians play the chess well, but the Iranians are the original authors. They're tough negotiators. They've been in the area for over 3,000 years, even before the introduction of Islam occupation by the Arabs in the 7th century AD. So these guys built a huge empire that you remember from history, clashed with ancient Greece and Rome, and fought with Greece and Rome for over 1,000 years. So these are masters of geopolitical games. We should not tell them what we're planning to do.
Well, Ariel, I want to talk a little bit about the broader reaction to President Trump's moves. The European Union is opposed to bringing Iran back to the table and trying to renegotiate this. They're hoping that U.S. Congress keeps this nuclear agreement intact. I'm just wondering, you know, there has been talk that perhaps taking a hard line could actually be advantageous for Russia. What's your take on how much political will there is to really renegotiate this?
The European position, the Russian position, and the Chinese position are all going to be crucial in the strategy the U.S. is pursuing. And of course, just as in case of North Korea, we would much rather achieve our strategic goals through negotiations and not through war, not through the use of force. Having said that, we still have a lot of means short of the use of force, short of war, including banking and economic sanctions against terrorist organizations and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, a mega terrorist organization that has an air force, controls ballistic missiles of Iran, is developing the nuclear program, and has presence all over the world. So it's much bigger than Al-Qaeda ever was. The IRGC finally was declared a terrorist organization, which it is. And now the consequences to their businesses are coming. The chickens are coming home to roost.
Ariel, let me just break in here, because let's just put all of what you said just aside for just a second. And if you can, just focus on the idea that Iran is the second largest exporter of oil from OPEC. It's the world's fourth largest oil producer. What are the goals that you believe can be exchanged? I don't mean in terms of passing legislation in the United States or getting European allies to agree with the Trump administration's yet-to-be-revealed strategy. But what goals can be achieved in dealing with what you describe as a hostile or confrontational force that just happens to have 10% of the world's proven oil reserves and 15% of its gas?
You're putting your finger on a very important geo-economic, if you want, issue, and that is a competition between Saudi Arabia and Iran for the regional dominance of the Middle East. The Saudis are Sunnis, the Iranians are Shia. We can and we should work with the Saudis to keep the oil prices down, but the Saudis are suffering, and the Saudis and the Russians are talking about cutting production. If production is cut, oil prices are going up, and our shale producers are going to step in. So the oil prices, if we are looking at the 55-60 marks, they may go up, and that will benefit Iran. So what can we do? We can and we should talk to main consumers to prefer oil from the United States and from our allies, from Canada, from Saudi, not from Iran, and keep Iranian oil off the markets and try to decrease their revenues.
All right, we're going to leave it there, but I want to thank you very much for joining us and giving us your thoughts. Ariel Cohen is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and director of the Center for Energy, Natural Resources, and Geopolitics at the IAGS. Well, where were you on October the 19th, 1987? Well, some people may not have been born by 1987, so therein lies the quandary when it comes time to at least remember Black Monday in 1987. So here to help us do so is Matt Maley. He is Managing Director and Equity Strategist at Miller Tabak. He is on site at the Boston Convention and Exhibition Center. Of course, Boston, home to Bloomberg 1061, Boston Newburyport, and 1330 in Metro West and the South Shore. Matt Maley, did you know that in 1987, the interest rate, the prevailing interest rate, was like 8.75%, and a gallon of gasoline was 89 cents.
89 cents, heaven forbid. And the rates were ever that high. I mean, geez, I'm old enough to remember them when they were in the teens.
Indeed. Thank you. Don't encourage me. When you were driving your Ford Escort down to the Solomon Brothers trading room, tell us a little bit about what it was like that day, and what are some of the things that you have put together to explain what happened on October the 19th, 1987.
Well, it was kind of a perfect storm, and we had the stock market had been going up for a long time, and you remember, investors and managers alike had all remembered the horrible bear market of the 1970s, and then of course they had all at least had some sort of a memory or learned very much from their parents of the Great Depression. So, geez, they were starting to get nervous about this market having a big run, and people in the institutional side were buying portfolio insurance. We've all heard about, but individual investors, again, they also were worried because they had a lot of money in mutual funds. Then there was a third leg that a lot of people don't talk about, and that was in the takeover areas. I mean, Ivan Boesky and these guys were the big stars back then on Wall Street, and the takeover stocks were highly leveraged. And what happened, and a lot of people don't know, is that the real catalyst really came out of Washington, D.C., when the Ways and Means Committee came out and decided they floated a trial balloon about changing the tax, the way these takeovers would, or the debt on these takeovers would be taxed. And these leveraged risk arbitrage guys all started getting some margin calls, started selling in an aggressive way, and that kind of started the whole thing rolling. Well, the dominoes started falling after that.
Matt, your note is really tremendous. You also talk about that people were worried about longer-term interest rates rising, and they weren't as worried about the effect of rising yields and lower prices in their bond portfolios as much as they were about potential takeover deals that would collapse due to tighter credit conditions. So really putting things into perspective. Matt, before we delve too far into history lane, can you draw any parallels from that period to today? Are we sort of setting ourselves up for a similar type of crash, or do you think that that was really a confluence of idiosyncratic events that will not be repeated today?
Well, I yes and no, or both is the way to put it. I guess on the one hand,
yes.
I do not think that we could have a one-day disaster like that. We have all the circuit breakers, and the Fed is. I think all central banks are ready and willing to provide liquidity when it is needed. So I think I'd very, very, very surprised. It would have to be some sort of a huge black swan to cause a 20% or 30% move just in a day or two. Because a lot of people forget that it was actually about a 35% drop over several days if you all in. But at the same time, we have a lot of whether it be we heard a lot about these algos and these high frequency traders, and of course. In the ETFs, these are all rules-based investors, and when the market goes to a certain thing, they're going to automatically buy. Well, that's we've seen that in a nice way in the last couple of years. But the flip side can happen as well. So at some point, we're going to have another bear market. Bear markets have not been outlawed. I am afraid that it could be again, not a crash over a couple of days, but we could see a 20 or 25% move over just a few weeks, which is not something that people will like very much.
Matt, there are not circuit breakers in certain bond markets. Do you think that they're more susceptible to a crash?
Well, that's certainly a thing. I mean, it was only just a year ago, or a year and a half ago, I should say. One of the things that, the real problem with the decline in oil prices that took place in the latter half of 2015 and very early 2016 was the almost crash in the high yield market. And like you said, no circuit breakers, liquidity can be very small there. So when you get that kind of forced selling, I mean, that's the whole thing, is that crashes only take place because of forced selling, not because of actual structural fundamental issues. And when you get highly leveraged fixed income markets and they start to, the bids disappear, it could cause serious problems. There's no question.
Matt, is there something about Friday trading and Monday trading that you can draw from history?
Well, the one thing is, I mean, it's funny. It's that, people on Fridays are worried about, geez, I won't be able to get to my money, or not get to my money, or do a trade over, for another couple of days. So sometimes they, they panic a little bit on Fridays. And it's the same thing on Mondays, is because over the weekend they start talking to each other. In 1987, that's kind of what happened. People started talking to each other and said, oh my gosh, the stock market was down 100 points. Back then that was like unheard of. And people started panicking and they started calling 1-800 mutual fund and redeeming their mutual funds. And so that's how the whole thing kind of started clicking in. And the thing is today, there is a reason that the stock market is open the Friday after of Thanksgiving, because they don't want the market closed 4 days in a row, because if that happens, if something big happens, panic, real panic could set in over 4 days. That's really the reason why they don't close the day after Thanksgiving. No other reason.
Matt Maley, thank you so much for joining us. Truly a fascinating note, and I recommend people read it. Matt Maley is a managing director and equity strategist at Miller Tabak & Company. The holy grail in the food industry, to create something that tastes decadent but allows you to stay slim. Here to talk about one development in the sugar industry is Eran Baniel, Chief Executive Officer and President of Du Matok, which is based in Petah Tikva in Israel. He is in our 1130 studios today. And Eran, your company makes a sugar product that basically just enhances how we taste sugar, correct? Rather, and reducing the amount of sugar included, rather than having an artificial substitute, correct? Can you tell us a little about that?
That is absolutely correct. What we do is we load the sugar onto a carrier, a mineral, very common in food. A tiny little bit of mineral is enough to carry a whole lot of sugar. And when those clusters of sweetness arrive at the receptors, they download the sugar at the receptors, and cheating, if you wish, the receptors to report something which is mild sweeter than the amount of sugar that you've put there.
About a 40% reduction, I believe. At least is that for sugar consumption if this were introduced?
Yes, you have here, I brought you, two examples. The Jelly Bellies are 50% sugar reduction, and the chocolate is 30%, just to show you. But we got complaint that the chocolate was still too sweet at 30% reduction. So we are continuing to reduce.
You know, one big question about the science behind reducing sugar is that if your body is expecting and experiencing a certain sweetness, it prepares for the calories that accompany it. In other words, if people eat something that is calorie reduced, they may eat more afterwards to compensate for the lack of calories that they received for the amount of sugar. This is one sort of complaint with artificial sweeteners. What have you found with respect to that?
It's interesting that you say that. It's a wonderful question, because what happens with our sugar is that sweetness is a teeny bit belated, but then lingers on. So you really won't reach out for the next bite so fast, because you really get a full sugary impression, taste, and satisfaction. So it's actually a way to reduce even further the temptation to take too much. So it's a lingering story too.
Give us an update on how far along you are in the commercialization of this. I know you raised, a little bit more than $8 million recently. You're announcing that. Where are you in the commercialization? And does this then go into the food service industry, perhaps in addition to just in a direct retail way?
We were very fortunate. We did very little PR, or it was usually to say, hey, we got some money invested in us or something. And what followed was an avalanche of emails to the website, etc. The whole world is looking for a sugar reduction solution which tastes great, which doesn't have all those aftertastes, etc. So what happened is wherever we had early success, like with chocolate, without naming names, because obviously I can't, but I wouldn't exaggerate, I think, if I say this startup from Israel is talking to over 60% of the sugar, chocolate industry in the world. And I'm meaning all the big ones.
Well, you have an ex-Nestle Nespresso executive as part of your executive team, I believe.
That is true.
So how much more expensive is it to produce these chemicals that have sugar on them that are that are expressed as sweeter?
I don't terribly go for the expression chemicals because it sounds like, oh, you know, we are using a mineral and the mineral is the most common mineral on earth.
I love this, by the way. You know, everything that we have is chemicals, right? I mean, they're chemicals coursing through our bodies, but it has taken on a sort of negative connotation. So we'll call it a mineral. Okay, so mineral with sweetener on it.
Yeah, yeah. And what happens is that we don't have one, let's say, sucrose, the normal table sugar, not one. We've got three different models. They differ by the surface of the mineral that we use, and they are better each for certain categories of applications. So we've got our sugar, which works marvelously in chocolate, dry applications, basically. And we have our sugar that works great in baked goods. And we talked to some of the giants there as well. We have more difficulties with sodas. Obviously, the sugar breaks at the tongue. Sodas are water, and we are less effective in sodas.
I want to thank you very much for coming in and enlightening us. Eran Baniel is the Chief Executive Officer and the President of Doumatok, that is Douxmatok.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast.
You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Pim Fox. I'm on Twitter at Pim Fox.
I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.